From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, a conversation about the vital, essential, but ultimately disposable Hollywood writer, with Oscar winner Akiva Goldsman. Plus, an agency assistant says, goodbye, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, adieu, in an email that got Hollywood's tongues a-wagging. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Happy Hollywood New Year. It's The Business from NPR. With half the calories and none of the taste, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Sitting around watching TV has never been great for your kids, but a new study released last week suggests that the idiot box may be even more insidious than we originally thought. Researchers at the University of Illinois examined the foods being advertised on kids' programming, and surprise, it turns out most products were overloaded with crap. The researchers considered more than 50,000 commercials seen by kids ages 2 to 11 and found that 98% of the food advertised was high in fat, sugar, or sodium. Reached for comment, a fast food industry spokesman boasted that at least there's no lead in Pizza Hut's pepperoni dipping sticks. Quote, there's not even lead in the creamy ranch dipping sauce. Meanwhile, it's apple, apple, apple. The computer company loves to issue announcements about its ever-increasing market dominance, and last week was no exception. Apple trumpeted that it had sold its millionth iPhone just 74 days after the device was released. The Wall Street Journal even reported last week that competition from Apple's iTunes has Yahoo considering either shutting down or completely overhauling its own music service. Upon hearing this news, stunned music lovers everywhere reacted by gasping, "Yahoo has a music service?" But as dominant as Apple is in music, it appears its strength in video is being challenged. 2 weeks ago, NBC announced it was dumping Apple's iTunes in favor of Amazon.com's Unbox service. Then, last week, News Corporation President Peter Chernin said that while he was open to making an online deal with iTunes for Fox shows and movies, he also issued a warning against any potential bullying from the man in the black turtleneck. Quote, "Let me say this," Chernin warned. "We're the ones who should determine what the fair price for our product is, not Apple." End quote. In other TV news, 3 years after Nipplegate, the lawsuits still reverberate. Last week, CBS argued in court that the FCC fines levied on the network for televising Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction during the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show would effectively censor U.S. broadcasting. CBS counsel Robert Corn Revere pressed the Third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn the $500,000 fine. In a rousing closing argument, Corn Revere issued this challenge. Mr. Chief Justice, tear down this bra. Finally, according to the Associated Press, Louisiana's former film commissioner pleaded guilty last Friday to taking about $60,000 in bribes to help inflate tax credits meant to lure film production to the state. Court papers filed in connection with his plea say Mark Smith took the money to approve inflated budgets for film productions. That resulted in inflated tax credits from the state, and he got a kickback. Neither the film production company involved nor the alleged source of the bribes was identified. Smith's sentencing is scheduled for December 5th. He could face a maximum of 15 years in prison and fines of $350,000. However, an unnamed Hollywood studio has already acquired Smith's script detailing the sordid story for $1.5 million and sunk it deep, deep into the North Atlantic. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, the talent agency email that got Tinseltown tongues a-wagon. But next, insecure execs make screenwriting the least secure job in show business. An oft-quoted scene in the Coen brothers' 1991 film Barton Fink gives you a sense of how many people in Hollywood view writers. In the scene, a writer, played by John Turturro, pleads for help from his producer, played by Tony Shalhoub, over lunch in the studio commissary.
Just having trouble getting started. It's funny, I'm blocked up. I just feel like I need some kind of indication of what's expected.
Wallace Beery, wrestling picture. What do you need, a roadmap?
Look,
You're confused. You need guidance. Talk to another writer.
Who?
Oh, Jesus. You throw a rock in here, you'll hit one. Do me a favor, Fink. Throw it hard.
Like it or not, every movie has to have a writer. And in many cases, maybe most cases, it could be more like a gaggle of writers. Writers are often hired and fired as the project moves from development to the screen, and for every written by credit on a major Hollywood film, there's often an equal number of writers who didn't get credit, even though they made some significant contribution. The new film I Am Legend is a great case study in both the fundamental importance and disposability of the screenwriter. The 1954 science fiction novel of the same name, by Richard Matheson, has already been adapted into two films, The Last Man on Earth in 1964 and the better-known 1971 movie The Omega Man. In the late 90s, a writer named Mark Protasevich penned a dark, new version of the Matheson novel that was picked up by Warner Brothers. Ridley Scott agreed to direct, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was set to star, but the project was shelved by the studio because it was just going to cost way too much. I Am Legend became the stuff of Hollywood legend for the way it bounced around town for almost a decade. Until writer and producer Akiva Goldsman got his hands on it. Goldsman, who won the Academy Award for adapting the screenplay to A Beautiful Mind, wrote a version of I Am Legend and nabbed Will Smith to star. Smith, a producer himself, then asked for a script that incorporated some of Mark Protasevich's original draft from the 90s and some of Goldsman's new adaptation. In his role as producer, Goldsman then rehired Protasevich to create a shooting script. Both their names will roll in the credits when the film debuts this December. But perhaps seven writers in all took a whack at I Am Legend in the intervening decade. And that means writers were hired and fired for reasons that probably had nothing to do with writing. As a writer, even Oscar winner Akiva Goldsman knows what it's like to get canned, and he's worked on major films for which he's not even gotten credit. But he's also a producer, giving him special insight into the writer's life. We spoke with him in his offices on the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank. Akiva Goldsman, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Is it possible anymore for one writer to have an idea, write it up, and see it go on screen?
Absolutely. Writers move around the merry-go-round of participation in large part as a result of people's fear, not because they can't do the job. Writing is a very odd piece of the movie business because it is traditionally kept outside of the production component. This is a historical short-sightedness, and there's a tendency on the part of writers to not know how to interact with production simply because they've never learned how to participate in the collaborative component of the process. And I think there is a tendency for production to find writers to be those weird guys who send in pages. And in all fairness, it's absurd. Costume designers design, then interact and redesign. Writers are, on the whole, able to write, interact, and rewrite. They are just often not given the chance. Writers can be threatening and annoying. And self-loathing. We're a fantastic bunch. But we're funny. I think that to write, you know, you got to kind of pretend that the world will obey you, right? I mean, you got to sort of sit there at the blank screen and go, well, now she'll say that. And, of course, production doesn't work that way. And what happens is writers are so used to being by themselves that the transition to then interacting and modifying what they're doing, you know, which is about criticism and modulation of creative product, is hard. Nobody likes to be told that they didn't do it perfectly the first time. You actually have to learn that it's part of your job.
Given all that, I mean, what are some of the reasons given to writers, both real and the reasons that are given to writers that are made up, for why they're being replaced?
Well, I think the truth behind it is generally that movies are sort of this competing convergence of fear and conviction. On a given day, fear or conviction wins. And when people are in their most frightened, they move the thing that is easier to move. And there is literally a convention in Hollywood of replacing writers. You don't hear about a string of costume designers, a string of production designers, a string of location managers being replaced on every movie. You've never heard of it, but everybody knows writers get replaced all the time. It's the weakest link, simply systemically. It's become traditionally the weakest link, so people bear down on it and break it. What they say to you is, we want to go in another direction. You know, we feel like you've gotten it almost all the way there. You know, we have somebody who's very good with the way she sounds. You know, he's got a kind of comedy that really works if he interacts with this guy that he, you know, we think you've given your best to them. Are you burnt out? I mean, and literally there, and it's fantastic because honestly, there are things you wouldn't say to your 9-year-old. You'd actually just go, can you do any better? Which is a step which is often skipped in the writer replacement merry-go-round. By the way, sometimes writers get replaced because they're bad or because they haven't mustered up the creative stuff that the scene requires. It's okay for anybody to be replaced in any job if they're not doing the job. The problem is it's so hard to define the job because it's about a creative point of view that really the only way it's ever going to work is if people are collaborative and talk to each other about what the expectations and the needs of the object, the screenplay, are.
What's the handoff like from one writer to another? I mean, do you ever seek out, I know you for this movie you did reach out to Mark Protasevich, but I mean, how common is it? Would it be weird for a writer to call up one who just finished the project?
We all do it all the time now, as much as possible.
Really?
Absolutely. I didn't do it once years ago. And on an adaptation, I replaced somebody, and they were so crestfallen, heartbroken. It never occurred to me. It was a book. I didn't think it could matter that much, and it was so naive of me. I realized how upset the first writer was, and from that moment on, I rarely will come on to anything that's active at all, and even if it's dead, I will call the original writer, ask them if they want to do it, if I'm producing it. I don't. It's pretty grim. It's a pretty bad feeling. It's happened to me a couple of times, and it's heartbreaking.
Part of the call is seems to be courtesy, that there's this fraternity among writers. How much of it is that, and how much of it is just a need to speak with someone who has just also, you know, been to the front lines of that project?
Generally, when you come onto a project later in the process, or you know, when you're replacing somebody, hopefully you're only doing it because it's going in such a wildly different direction. So it's not really that much about, gee, did you try that? I've done that a couple of times. Ron Bass and I used to do that on Geisha, a project which neither of us have credit on, but we're both writers on it sequentially. And we certainly, you know, a couple of times talked about the object and creatively. And Mark Protasevich and I talk a lot.
How much work can you do on a project and still not get credit for it?
As a writer?
Yeah.
Almost all of it.
Really?
Yeah. Our guild has a real vulnerability when it comes to the credit process. I have been unbelievably lucky. I don't have a movie that I could complain about. That's remarkably rare for someone who's been around as many pictures as I have. As a writer, you can, and I know people well who have done great work, truly great work, who are not credited for it, who are contractually precluded from talking about it by the guild, by who can never own it, who can never claim it. And it's heart-killing.
You're not contractually prohibited, are you? I mean, you could tell us.
I could. If they were movies that I were involved with, I would.
Oh,
you
okay.
Know. Well, I'll tell you this. And now I'll violate the minimum basic agreement. A fellow named Charlie Mitchell is as fundamental a contributor to Cinderella Man as any writer. He's a fantastic screenwriter who spent years working on that screenplay and created the object that so many of us were attracted to. It happens all the time.
That's cold comfort if you're Charlie Mitchell. Can he go out and say, well, look, here are my drafts of...
Everybody knows. You can. Everybody within the business knows. And it is cold comfort.
So has Charlie Mitchell ever been able to benefit from that and say, be hired because of the script he wrote, even though that nobody in America knows?
Sure. I think it helps him get work, but it doesn't help him as much as if he were credited for it. I mean, everybody tells you, and it's a kind of it's a self-soothing system that takes place within the construct of Hollywood. Look, everybody knows, everybody knows, everybody knows. This is what you hear when you're wondering whether you're going to get credit or sure, everybody knows, but not really.
I'm curious, what is it like for you? I mean, you know, part of your day hopefully is spent saying, I'm Akiva Goldsman, Oscar-winning screenwriter for A Beautiful Mind. You can't do this to me. But you've been fired. What's the process like for you? What happens after that? Do you?
And by the way, yes, I spend all my days going, I'm Akiva Goldsman, to my wife, who also doesn't care. But some years ago, right after I had won the Academy Award, I got a project that I was working on, a project here called Superman versus Batman, was abandoned. We were in pre-production.
Pre-production means sets are being built.
Yeah.
Costumes are being fitted.
Yeah.
This is not a theoretical enterprise anymore.
It was not a theoretical enterprise. And I was actually just polishing up a script, a really, really well-written script, but was working quite hard on it. And they shut the project down. And I remember calling Ron Howard, and I said, I get it now. None of it's personal. Because if there's any day where I can tell myself I don't suck, it's today. And I'm still getting shut down. So the fact is, the business is just the business. And up until that moment, whenever something had happened, I would always say to myself, if I were just a little better, if I were just a little more recognized, if critics liked it, or if it made a little more money, or if the last one had just, then this bad thing wouldn't happen to me. And on that day, it was weirdly liberating because I realized it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what awards you have. It doesn't matter what you've written before. You are as subject to the vagaries of this business as anybody else. And we're paid a lot to take it on the chin. Sometimes in Hollywood it's personal, but sometimes everywhere it's personal. I mean, the fact is, you know, ultimately people will tolerate your being a dick until you don't have power, and then they will slaughter you. And which has always been so interesting to me, because it so obviously means don't be a dick, because eventually, you know, probably Thursday next, I will stumble, fall down, and I will need somebody who was subordinate to me then to hire me later. Everybody remembers everything. And we pretend we don't because it's the politics of the business. But nobody's forgotten a single thing ever about the way somebody treated them.
Akiva Goldsman, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks. It was fun.
I Am Legend hits theaters in December. After a short break, an assistant at William Morris fires the agency. Lovingly. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Josh Shy Steinberger was an assistant to Uber agents David Lahner and Jeff Shumway at the William Morris Agency for the last 2 years. When he decided to leave the agency to pursue his career as a writer and comedian last month, he sent a good-natured, if barbed, goodbye email to his friends and colleagues. But the email started to make the rounds throughout Hollywood and caused quite a stir. Here's Shy himself reading a bit of the email entitled, I Love You, WMA.
There are a lot of things I'm going to miss about this place. I will miss mistaking Molly Sims for a new assistant and urging her to come quickly to the atrium for free kookaroo on a Thursday night. I will miss whooping and hollering at the top of my lungs for John Travolta in the 151 lobby. I will miss trying unsuccessfully to get lucky with a gorgeous summer intern in the legal files closet of the 150 building. And I will miss sexual harassment training, which has been enormously educational for me. I will miss Chris Petrickin and Christian Muirhead chastising me for being featured in Esquire's 2005 Profile of the American Man. Hey, I can't help being so damn sexy. I will miss introducing myself to Jim Wyatt at the 2005 WMA Christmas party, and Jim responding that he recalled seeing me unshaven on October 16th of that year.
You don't need to know that Jim Wyatt is the head of William Morris or why people were hollering at the top of their lungs for John Travolta to get a sense that this letter is an unusual peek inside a rarefied and secretive culture. We're happy to have Shy on the phone from his childhood home in Teaneck, New Jersey, to talk more about life inside Hollywood's oldest talent agency. Shy Steinberger, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
It's just, first of all, this letter seemed actually very good-hearted, and I wanted to ask you, was it?
You know, it's funny, Claude. I'm happy you noticed that, because a lot of people perceive the email as being like a big giant f*** you to William Morris on my way out, which it most certainly was not. And the funny thing was, it was originally sent out, I sent it out to my William Morris colleagues, and the people who worked at William Morris were all aware that I loved William Morris and that I had a really awesome time there, and that when I was thanking, you know, my two bosses, David and Jeff, at the end, it was actually very sincere, even though it seemed, you know, funny. It was heartfelt, and I had a great relationship with both of them, and, you know, it was almost like running jokes at the company when I worked for David that we had, like, a really tight relationship, and the same thing with Jeff Shumway when he came over from ICM months later, so... It really was good-hearted. I think I wrote it the night before, and I took out anything that I thought was in any way mean and malicious, and I left what I thought was just sort of good-natured and funny, and also nothing that was confidential, just because obviously I was going to send it to a lot of people at the company.
How did it leak?
You know, I don't know. I think that, like most things that sort of become, you know, sort of just funny emails, people forward them back and forth. I think the assistants... William Morris probably sent it to their friends at other companies, you know, production companies, studios, and then I think it just sort of took on a life of its own. I obviously knew when I wrote it that it was going to be, there'd be a bit of a an uproar when I sent it out, and but I had no idea it was going to be so widely circulated.
Well, before we get to why people talked about your exit, let's talk about why you took the job. And if you could, compare what you expected with what you got.
Well, I came out to Hollywood as soon as I graduated from college in the summer of 2004, and I graduated with a degree in philosophy, which was completely useless. When I finished, I had nothing to do. In college, I was, you know, screenwriting. I was taking screenwriting classes at Harvard, and I was doing stand-up comedy in the Boston community. And then when I graduated from Harvard, I did stand up in New York City that the summer after I graduated, because that's where I'm from. I'm from New York, and I live in New Jersey. And I knew that, or I felt that, in order to really take, you know, entertainment seriously and take everything to the next level, I had to move to Los Angeles. But I wasn't yet getting paid for my stand up, so I thought I'd get a job in the business. So I interviewed at all the major agencies, you know, CAA, William Morris, ICM. CAA gave me an offer, and I started there as a floater.
Well, what is that, first of all?
Every agency keeps a bunch of trained, you know, young assistants on reserve just in case somebody calls in sick. You could sort of easily fill in the vacancy because there's so much sort of, you know, unique sort of culture and little, you know, aspects of companies that only you can know if you've been there for a while, and personalities and understand the power structure and the hierarchy. So it's sort of like a better
just
way.
In case Kevin Huvane's third assistant is out sick and no one can make his iced tea just the way he likes it, you can step in, something like that?
Exactly. That's pretty much exactly what it is. And the truth is, it's a really good thing, because if you do it and you do a good job, then you'll be noticed, and you could hopefully either work for that particular person, or that person who you floated for will put in a good word for you. I worked for two very impressive agents there, both of whom I immensely disliked. I won't say their names, just to be whatever.
Just to live.
Just to live. I don't want to get on CAA's bad side. I hated them both, but I actually did work for two extremely prestigious agents at CAA, and I just basically quit one morning at 11 a.m. after I was treated in a way in which I didn't even know was possible.
What happened?
Well, basically, I had made a dinner reservation for one of the guy I was working for with someone, and that someone didn't show up. And the next morning, when my agent came in, he told me, you know, where was so-and-so last night? And I was, you know, I was bewildered. I was like, well, he wasn't there. And he's like, no. So sure enough, the guy who didn't show called up, apologized, and, you know, my boss was like, oh, no worries, you know, no big deal. Went to a staff meeting, came back out 3 hours later, and he goes, hey, Shad, did you figure out what happened last night? And I'm like, what do you mean? The guy just didn't show. He called you to apologize. He's like, what the f*** is the matter with you, Shy? What the f***? Harvard boy, can't you f***ing write? Went out of his mind. And, you know, I think most assistants sort of just swallow that kind of shit in Hollywood, and they let people abuse them that way. And I certainly wasn't going to stand for that. I put on my sport jacket and walked out the building right there at 11 a.m. on a Wednesday. I'll never forget. I walked out. I called my parents. I was like, hey, I just quit my job. I'm going to come home for a few months. I went to 24-hour fitness, you know, went jogged on the treadmill, and then took a two-month break from Hollywood trying to figure out what was the next step.
What was the reaction of the your fellow floaters?
Well, at that point, I was an assistant, but the reaction was I started getting phone calls and text messages like, dude, where are you? What the f***? You know, I heard the rumor you just, like, disappeared.
Were you seen as someone who is engaging in aberrant behavior by not taking it? Or were you a hero?
I got a lot of respect from assistants. I think that the thing with Hollywood is people have this dream, and they, you know, and not just the artists, the people who are pursuing the business side as well, whether they're working at agencies or, you know, production companies or studios, and they want it so badly that they will tolerate anything pretty much to get to where they want to be. And I certainly didn't feel that way. I think part of it is just different people, you know, respond differently to different situations. I certainly wanted, you know, my dream just as badly as anyone else, but I guess I drew the line, and I felt that he had crossed it, especially since I hadn't really, and this is classic Hollywood, I had not really done anything wrong. I had confirmed dinner, and, like, this guy didn't show up, and next thing I know, like, I'm getting yelled at after the guy who didn't show up apologized. It was like, the whole thing was such nonsense.
Shai Steinberger had been an assistant at William Morris for more than 2 years when he quit last month to pursue his career as a writer and comedian. His goodbye email to the William Morris staff had tongues flapping all over Hollywood. We'll have part two of our conversation with Shai with fascinating details about life inside the agency next week. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.